Hello and welcome to a special bonus episode of The Sewers of Paris. We're going to be going beyond The Sewers of Paris with special guest Alexis Nicole Whitney.
I went into a coma for 2 weeks. My heart has stopped twice. If my heart were to stop the third time, they weren't going to revive me.
The topic is Annie Lennox, Tu Wong Fu, and drag families. No matter how thoroughly you've planned, life has a way of taking you by surprise. And when it does, it's often family that gets you through the tough times. Alexis was born to a woman unprepared for motherhood, and so grandparents stepped in to raise her. And as she grew older, Houston's drag scene provided a second family where she was free to express herself more freely. But it was an unexpected health crisis that brought both families together when their daughter needed the most. By the way, The Sewers of Paris is made possible by everyone who pledges a dollar or more a month on Patreon. If you're enjoying the show, head over to sewersofparis.com and click support the show on Patreon to help make this podcast possible. Or you can support The Sewers of Paris for free by leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice. That really helps people find the show. And if you're in Seattle and you want to see some drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons, mark your calendars for June 21st. We're doing our next Dungeons & Drag Queens show just in time for Pride. Tickets are now on sale at queensofadventure.com. Now, here's Alexis. Well, this week I'm speaking to Alexis Nicole Whitney. Thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited about this. So
what's the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. I lived there 33 years of my life. My grandparents were my legal guardians. They adopted me after being 2 days old. My birth mother, I was my grandmother's Mother's Day gift. So she raised me and adopted me. And they were the ones that put me through everything, through high school, through 1 year college. And, you know, they were the ones that, I guess, raised the person that I am today. So it was exciting, you know, being able to realize that they were people that wanted more children and weren't able to because of their age. And for her to, you know, struggle and have to do what she had to do to raise me and my brother was an amazing experience, because that lady was a fighter. My grandmother was a fighter as well as my grandfather, because my grandfather also had prostate cancer. So he lost a battle to that. And being able to be raised by two individuals that were amazing, like as they were, you know, and my grandfather was not my birth grandfather. He was, my grandmother married him after, you know, she had my mother. So he raised us not knowing that we were not his blood as well, you know, and to be able to realize that that man was a strong individual and did what he did for me and my brother was an amazing experience.
And then did you have, like, you know, in the work that you do today, you're very much in a creative field. Did you have entertainment, books, movies, TV, music, games, that made a big impact on you?
Actually, you know, one of the things that really made me, like, realize and start noticing what I wanted to do was actually Jerry Springer.
really?
Yeah, because, you know, they had, there was a couple of episodes where they had, you know, transsexuals, men that live as women. And they had several of them that were on there that I would watch and was like inspired by them because I wanted to be like them. You know, ever since I was little, I knew that I was a little boy that was trapped in, you know, a girl trapped in a little boy's body. You know, I've always wanted to live my life as a woman, but out of respect to my grandparents, of course, I never did it until their passing. And being able to watch Jerry Springer and see those transsexuals on TV and stuff like that was what made me realize, okay, I want to be like them. You know, it's just like, also like, sadly, Jesse Raphael had interviews with a transsexual by the name of Tandy Andrews, and she was on there, and she was from San Antonio. So it was talk shows like that that made me realize, hey, I can do that, you know, and especially because they were from San Antonio, you know, I was like, you know, it's close to home. You know, she lives in the same city as I do. So, and they were like, well, received when they were on the TV show, you know, that it just was amazing to be able to experience that.
Now, so I'm not familiar with those appearances, but my impression of, you know, how Jerry Springer shows, you know, how guests are usually welcomed on those shows is that there's sometimes
drama, yeah.
Drama and hostility from the audience is sort of a portrayal of like, well, what you're doing is very strange and we don't like that.
Right.
But it sounds like were audiences more welcoming and
yeah,
and
actually they were, and that's what I'm saying. When I saw that, I was kind of like, oh, okay, this is different, because it was a show about transsexuals, you know, men that live as women, and they came out in their swimsuits, they came out in their, you know, it was like they were called pageant queens, you know, because that's what, you know, a lot of us do is the competitions and stuff, and they were well received, and you know, they of course they were curious about certain things and were in awe because they couldn't, okay, how did they put that away, or where did they hide it, or you know, where did they get their breasts and stuff like that. So they had questions about their personal life, but it was nothing to where, you know, of course Jerry Springer was known for the drama and the, you know, oh, that's a man, you know. No, it was very respectful and it was very well received, and that's what made me really look at life in a different perspective, because I was like, you know what, we could be accepted, you know. And it's true nowadays, it's like eating Skittles, you know. Nobody really looks at people like that anymore because they're not judgmental the way they used to be back in the day.
So when you saw these shows and you felt something there speaking to you, did you feel like if you were to express yourself authentically that you would be welcomed in the same way, or were you afraid of, you know, because I imagine in Texas it would be difficult to live openly like that, especially at a young age.
Yeah, at first I was kind of scared of it, because not only, you know, because of course I was in a man's body, but you know, man, with being in a man's body, it comes with being, you know, have a lot of facial hair, have a lot of, you know, hair on the legs. And I was always scared of, okay, during the day, you know, we still have to live our life as a woman. And that's, I give my hats off to real women, because it's hard. It's nothing easy, not just because we have to try to look like them, but because they have to keep themselves up. You know, they have to take care of their hair. They have to do their makeup. You know, we have to do all that. And it's a lot of work. So with that, I was kind of like, you know, I have to worry about my 5 o'clock shadow during the day, or, you know, hair on my legs that you can see when the sun is out. So it was kind of that kind of scared, but not more of the community accepting me, because once I knew that I was in the right body physically, I knew that I would be accepted. Like, I don't regret it one bit, you know, getting my breasts, getting, you know, taking my hormones. Now I feel like the person I never was.
Did you have other folks, like, after you saw people on talk shows, like, were you on, like, alert and, like, watching out for other people who were living authentically and expressing the, you know, affirming the gender that they knew themselves to be?
Yeah, actually, when I, you know, my birth mother is a lesbian, you know, and she was very the macho looking, flannel wearing lesbian with a short haircut, with cowboy boots, you know, very the vaquero, the way they say for the Mexican men that like to dress like very cowboy boots with, you know, the belts and flannels and stuff. So I kind of witnessed it with her, you know, and then of course, at the same time, I started going out to the clubs at the age of 16, you know, I had an ID that showed that I was of age, you know, I would sneak into the bar and I started seeing, you know, the transgender there. And that's when I started meeting people and stuff. And of course I was the new kid on the block and everybody would try to meet me, and, you know, they would say I was a very handsome boy, you know. And so they would, I started to get to meet a lot of people and realize that, hey, there's a whole different new community society that I never knew that was, you know. I just knew, of course, because of the straight society, going to school and all that. And then there was gay boys at school that I kind of knew were there, but I didn't want to face it because I was afraid of what people would think. And, you know, my brother was almost about 3 years older than I was, so we were at the same high school and stuff. So being able to go to the bar was like a whole different world, you know, and it was kind of like, oh, okay, we are accepted. You know, there's a whole lot of us. They're by the dozens, you know. And finally, you know, I also saw Tu Wong Fu. That was another movie that I got to see, that, you know, John Leguizamo playing Chi Chi in the character, and Patrick Swayze and Noxzema, being able to see them and how they got accepted in the little town when they went, and, you know, all that stuff kind of made me even more excited and realize, hey, you know, it is accepted. You know, it's just on how you carry yourself, of course. You know, if you want to be a woman, carry yourself like a woman. Don't try to be a transsexual and then, you know, be disrespectful to yourself, because if you don't respect yourself, others won't respect you.
Did you become aware of a difference between, for example, Tu Wong Fu, where they're drag queens, they're men who are inhabiting female characters, and people who are transgender, where it's not that they're men dressed as women or women dressed as men.
Right.
You know, that it's a distinction that I think a lot of straight people might not be aware of. Is it something that you learned about through the bars or through other people around you?
Yeah, most definitely through the bars. Yeah, most definitely. I realized, because at first I didn't know the difference, you know. Of course, I didn't know a drag queen or the difference between a drag queen and a transsexual until I started going to the shows at, back then it was the old Paper Moon, you know, before they switched over to the Saint. And being able to see the shows was, you know, realizing that a transsexual is the one who lives their life as a woman that has breasts, you know, has the long hair, versus the drag queen would just put on a wig, put on makeup, and then, you know, there's foam that they put in as padding and stuff, and when the show is done, they take it off and live their life as a man, you know? So I started realizing that once I started going to the bar. You know, when I saw the movie, of course, it was already kind of time after that I had started going to the bar, so I kind of started putting things together and be like, oh, okay, you know, where John Leguizamo to me was looked like a transsexual, you know, because he looked like the most, I guess, womanly out of the three of them. So I didn't really realize it until after I knew who the character, I mean, the actor was, that I was like, oh my God, he's actually a man. And that's, he was a drag queen, you know, in the movie, he could pass as a transsexual. And I started realizing that, you know, and that's when all that came together after I witnessed it basically more at the club.
So paint a picture for me of the club. Like, were there like performances there, or like what would you see when you walked in?
Of course, you know, men on men, women on women, feminine guys running around, you know, then the drag queens and, you know, transsexuals and all that. And there was like you would walk into the door and it was a little quiet bar where they just sat around and played pool, and they had this little bar and stuff. But then you went to the left and that's where the show bar was at. You went up some stairs and there was a big bar and there was a big stage with, you know, with curtains and all that and stuff. And that's where they would do the shows, you know, and that's where all the magic, as I would say, would happen, you know, where the men transform into women and, you know, the transsexuals transform into performers, into artists, because that's an art, you know. And it was like an all Oz. It was like I was home. You know, when I got there, it was like, oh my God, I'm home. This is where I belong. This is where, you know, this is where I need to be.
Well, it sounds like family was super important for you growing up. And you mentioned that it was through your mother that your birth mother, that you got a sense of like that sort of lesbian aesthetic of the flannel and the boots. Can you tell me a little about what your relationship with her was like?
Sad to say, I would have thought once she found out that I was gay, we would be a lot closer. But I don't know. I really never sat down and talked to her about it, but we were never close because to me, she was just my birth mother and my grandmother was my mom, if that makes any sense. Because, you know, my grandmother was the one that raised me. So I guess it was a little bit of bitterness in my part because I was not, I didn't realize that she did it for a good reason. You know, she did it because she knew that she wasn't going to be able to raise me and my brother. And she knew that my grandmother would give us a good home. But yet I was still having that kind of a little bit of the bitterness because she should have done it. You know, why did you have us when you knew that you couldn't take care of us? But she did it because my grandmother wanted kids. She wanted more kids, and that's why she did it. You know, and my grandmother always wanted my mom to have a family and find a man that she can raise kids with and stuff. And my mother, of course, never wanted that. You know, she wanted to be a lesbian, and she was attracted to women. And my grandma was forcing something on my mother that she could never do for her. So that's how she had us, you know. And being able to see that, you know, I thought she was going to be more accepting towards me and kind of be closer to me, and we would have a relationship to where I could run to her for anything, and it never happened like that. You know, it kind of surprised me once she found out that I was transitioning and stuff like that. You know, like one incident, she used to be a waitress at a restaurant. After I started transforming, you know, or transforming and stuff and taking hormones, I went into the restaurant where she worked at because she would work late at night, and I was dressed up, of course. I had just done the show, and I walked in, and she was working. And the people at the restaurant had noticed that I walked in, and she didn't say anything. She didn't tell them anything about her knowing me, that I was her son or, you know, daughter, whatever the case may be. She didn't tell them anything, but she stayed quiet to see what they would say about me. You know, and to me, I was kind of like, what? You know, like, it threw me off. It threw me for a loop because I was like, you know, I would expect like her to be like, oh my God, that's my daughter, that's my son. Isn't she beautiful? No, she just kind of like sat back and act like she didn't know us. She waited on us and said hi, but I knew something was funny because I was like, she's not like this all the time. What's going on? Well, she came out and said that she was just trying to see what people were saying, like when I got there, and she just wanted to see the reaction of others, which to me, I felt like she was a little embarrassed of me. And I think that's what it boiled down to, you know. And after that, I totally lost a lot of respect for her. Of course, she's still my mother, and I will always be thankful that she birthed me, because if not, I wouldn't have had the life with my grandparents that I did. But I've lost a lot of respect towards her because of that incident.
Is it something that you've ever spoken to her about? Like, about how you wanted her to be a little more, I don't know, to take more... and a more active role in your relationship with you?
No, I never really have brought it up to her, you know, because when we try, you know, even my older brother tries to talk to her and tries to bring her around with, you know, when they have their family stuff. And, you know, I tried to call her, and she's just, I think she's the one that really pushes us away, because we've tried to have a relationship with her and she's never wanted them, I guess, you know. So I just think that, I mean, you know, I've tried. I did my part and I tried to be, you know, in a relationship with her as far as like have the son, daughter, mother relationship. But I don't think she's wanting that. You know, I think she's always been an individual who likes to be by herself. Doesn't like to have, like whenever she's sick, she doesn't like to tell us. She doesn't like to, you know, and she'll text us for our birthday. And, you know, once in a while she'll check up on us. But other than that, yeah, she's never wanted a relationship with us.
It sounds like having your grandparents there as essentially your parents,
yeah.
That they were the ones who were really looking out for you.
Oh, yeah.
But also, I'm also hearing that there's a lot of pressure from them on your birth mother to not be a lesbian. So I imagine you must have felt a lot of pressure to, you know, conform to what their expectations of a man was.
Yeah, and actually, once like I got into high school, I think they started noticing, because ever since I was little, you know, I played with Barbies. I never went outside to play sports. You know, when I was in high school, I ran cross country and I ran track and I was in band and I was a cheerleader and I played basketball and all that. But I did that because I knew, you know, that's what I like doing. But I never liked being outside with the boys, playing with G.I. Joes or anything. And I always would play with Barbies. That it was to the point where I would beat up my little girl cousin because she would take the wedding Barbie away. And that was my favorite Barbie, you know. So they knew that I was that kind of, you know, they knew I was different. And when I started getting into high school, they saw it more once I started being a cheerleader, and they would go to the football games and, you know, they would support me and they would sit in the audience. And my brother was a football player and I was a cheerleader. And, you know, a lot of the guys would pick up my brother and say, oh, you know, your brother's gay, blah, blah, you know. But my grandparents were, regardless on how much they wanted to face it or not, they were always supportive towards me, you know. And then my junior, senior year was when I started dressing up, and they knew I did it. You know, my grandmother would buy me little jewelry for, you know, women jewelry and little like pearls and earrings and stuff. And would always tell me, you know, when you come home, make sure that you hide because, you know, your grandfather might be getting up soon and I don't want him to see you with the makeup. And, you know, so she was more accepting. And my grandfather knew it as well, but was very the old fashioned Mexican man that didn't want to see it and rather not talk about it. And, you know, would crack jokes every now and then, but they both loved me unconditionally, and they would always do everything they had to do to make sure that I was happy and I had everything that I needed. And, you know, and it was just an amazing experience with them. I wouldn't, you know, they raised the incredible person that I am today.
And then you also had that as an outlet. You had that bar, and I forget, what was the name of the bar that you were going to?
When I first started going out, it was called the Paper Moon, and then they had a new owner, and it was called the Saint after that.
Gotcha. And so you're going to the Paper Moon / the Saint. Was there a point where you started performing as well?
Yeah, and what happened was I started meeting people, of course. And as soon as I started going out, I would go out with my best friend. His name was Ruben. And we both, you know, dressed up and stuff. We found some individuals that, I don't know if you're aware, but in the gay community, we have families. You know, we build our own families. We have like a drag mother and, you know, a drag daughter, drag sons, you know, drag grandbabies, you know, aunts and uncles. It's just like a gay family. And I met these individuals that took us under their wing and one of them was my drag mother, and her name at the time was Shantae Whitney. You know, she retired from doing drag, and that's how the Alexis Nicole Whitney came in part, because the Alexis Nicole was the name that I've always wanted, and Whitney was from her last name. So we were asked to be a part of the family, and that's where I started building my own family, you know, where I had my gay family that I would run to. And, you know, during the week when we had school, I would go stay at the house with them. And, you know, they would make sure I get up in the morning, me and my best friend, to take us to high school in the morning and make sure we went to school and finished school and graduated and stuff like that. So not only did I have my grandparents, but I had my gay family that was accepting and made sure we did what we had to do to keep, you know, to finish school.
Did your biological family and your gay family ever meet each other?
Yes, most definitely. They knew that those were the people that I was hanging out with. I don't know if they really understood the whole gay family thing. Like, oh, that this is my drag mother or this is my drag sister. You know, my drag sister, Danielle, Keith, would always go pick me up at the house. And, you know, my grandparents loved him and, you know, whatever. And they got to meet everybody. But I don't know if they ever connected the whole gay family with the, you know, biological family thing, kind of, you know, because they were older and, you know, they just knew that they were friends of mine and people that took care of me when I was out. So,
yeah, I guess when you get down to it, just having somebody there, like knowing, okay, well, I care about this person and this, you know, like from your grandparents' perspective, we care about Alexis, although I know that wasn't the name you're going by at the time.
Right. I was. As soon as I started going out to the gay bars was when I started doing drag. Because I went out maybe at the end. It was like in the middle of 93. Well, by October Halloween weekend of 93 was when I dressed up, and that was my name from the get-go. I never changed it. I never went by a different name. It was always Alexis. So everybody already started knowing me as Alexis. You know, because in the gay community, once you do drag, oh, that's the name they call you, whether you're a boy or a girl or whatever, they start calling you by that name. And that's the name that sticks with you. So, you know what I'm saying? So it was just, they knew who I was by that. And that's how people started getting to recognize who I was.
Did that feel different? Like when people started calling you by your actual name, like, were you like, okay, this feels like something has changed?
When they started calling me Alexis, most definitely it made me feel like, oh, I'm home. Like I said, you know, I'm home. This is where I belong. This is, you know, what I've always wanted. I felt like I was, you know, on cloud nine. I felt like I was finally accepted. I felt like the woman that I never was, you know, and I started realizing where it was to the point where I would dress up every night, Monday through Sunday, just to go to the bar because, you know, I had already started growing my hair out and, you know, I learned how to do my makeup and, you know, I was fortunate to do that. So I started buying girl clothes, and I would not go to the bar if I was not dressed up.
So tell me about the performing that you would do.
Well, I started that following May of 94. They had a talent night. On Tuesday nights, it was Paulette Lace Talent Night, and they would have it for the Saints Newcomer of the Year. And what you would do is you would have to win a week, and then at the end of the month, the weekly winners would go for the month and win the month. And then when they had the 12 months, they would have the competition in January and have the newcomer of the year where all 12 months competed against each other. And that's how I started, was I won a talent night. The first time I did it, I remember it was a purple pocket t-shirt and some blue jean shorts with some little black sandals. I didn't know, you know, that they used these extravagant costumes with rhinestones and beads and all that. I just knew I wanted to be on stage. I was always a dancer because, you know, I was in cheerleading. So they showed me a mix, and I got the mix. I learned the mix, and I started dancing. And I went on stage, and I won that first week, and I won that first month. So that started the whole Alexis Nicole Whitney trance.
What were the songs that you would perform to?
It was a dance mix, actually. It was Keep It Coming. It was the name of the song. I don't remember the name of that. It was just the drag. As we call it, it was a drag mix. And it had all these different kinds of music that back in the day were the popular songs to dance to, and that's what I did.
So it sounds like that first time, not knowing sort of the pageant type look of like the big hair and the jewelry and everything, it sounds like you went up on stage in sort of a more informal kind of look.
Yeah, it was more like, I just want to be out here and, you know, I just want to dance and I just want to do what I need to do and just be on stage and be in the spotlight. And that's what I was more worried about than worried about the look and, oh, I want to look expensive and all that. I didn't learn that until a couple of years later. you know, because of course I was new to the scene and stuff. So I didn't know what they were expecting or what they were looking for. I just knew I wanted to be in the spotlight and I wanted to be on stage.
How did it feel to be on stage?
Oh, it felt amazing. It felt like just like when I was a cheerleader. You know, I always liked to be in front of crowds. You know, I was my freshman year, I was a class, you know, the class president. My sophomore year, I was the vice president. I always liked him. I always wanted to be a leader. I was always a leader. I always wanted to be in front of everybody. I wanted to be in charge of everything and wanted to, because I've always had those strong leadership skills, you know. And when I was a junior, I tried out for head cheerleader. And because I was a male, they weren't allowing me to be the head cheerleader. So I was co-captain with my best friends because of me being a male. So I was in charge of the cheerleading squad. And then, of course, my senior year, I was assistant drum major. So, you know, I got to be in front of the whole crowd, and just being in front of crowds was always something I always enjoyed and really, really looked forward to, because it just, I love to be on stage and I love to perform and I have the passion for that. So
what's going through your head when you're up on stage performing?
Now, a whole different story, because of course now I'm visually impaired versus to where I wasn't when I first started. Now it's like, it's weird because I know the song and I feel the song, but yet I can hear people talking, and I just listen sometimes to see what they're saying, because it's like a high to me, you know, because they're like, oh my God, she's blind. You know, and she's still doing it and she looks so beautiful and, you know, so forth and so forth. And, you know, it's just, it's amazing. It's just like, when I'm on stage, I don't worry about anything, any problems I have, any stress, anything. You know, when I'm on stage, it's just, I'm free. You know, I'm me. I'm Alexis Nicole Whitney. I'm on stage. I'm having fun. I forget about any problems that are going on off stage. You know, so it just allows me to be a person who's free on stage.
Now, you'd mentioned that it took you a couple years to learn the, like, glamour pageant sort of look. How did you learn that?
Well, through my family, through my drag family, like Shantae, and then because she was already in it, and once I won the month, they started saying, okay, now we have to prepare and we have to, you know, look for dancers and get costumes. And I'm still kind of like, okay, where's all this coming from? You know, because I was working, but it wasn't like a job to where, oh, I have enough money to pay for hundreds of dollars of costumes and beads and stones. And, you know, so it was still kind of like, no, I don't think I have all this money to do this. So, you know, little by little, they started telling me, okay, well, this is where you can get this, and this is what you need to do with this. And that just, you know, it took off from there.
Yeah, I don't think people always realize just how expensive drag can be.
Oh, no. I don't think they have not in a slight of idea, unless you're a performer, you'll know. But even sometimes some of the performers, like the newcomers, don't realize it's a lot of money. Where I tell you, where we spend money, where we could probably buy two houses, you know, and have two homes where they're paid for and taken care of with two cars and, you know, two, you know, lake houses. It's a lot of money because it takes, you know, we have different categories in different systems where we have a creative costume that's about, you know, a couple of $1,000s versus to an evening gown where that's another $2,000-$4,000 worth, you know, and it's beaded and stoned and for you to get the fabric and get the labor made. And it's a lot of money and people don't realize it. And, you know, and I wish people would really know and be able to see behind the scenes on what it takes to get to the competitions.
So tell me about how your act evolved over time. Like, as you were learning from your family and winning more contests, like, what changed about the way that you were performing?
Actually, you know what changed it? Me becoming blind, you know, because when I was able to see, I was about wanting to be a woman and wanting to meet guys. And, you know, I didn't take the competition seriously. I was just wanting to be a girl, you know, and it was more about, oh, I want to be fish, you know, like the terms that they say, oh, she's fishy, or, you know, she wants to be a girl. I was more about that. But when I went blind November 7th of 98, that's when I started taking the competitions more serious, because I knew that all eyes were going to be on me, because one, there's never been a blind transsexual that has competed and won until I came along, you know? So that really made me realize, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to inspire people and let people know that regardless of what kind of obstacles or, you know, obstacles come in the way, you have to overcome them. you know, and if you want to be something or win something or accomplish something, it's up to you to make it happen, you know, and never give up on your dreams and goals.
So can you tell me a little about that day that you mentioned that when you went blind?
Well, what was going on was it was in October. I was getting a lot of headaches, you know, like on the lower part of my head. And I just, you know, when I was able to see, when I would dance, I would, you know, flip my hair around and, you know, do all these little flips and stuff. So I thought that I had pulled a muscle and I was starting to get a lot of headaches. And mid-October, I started getting them, you know, worse and worse. I had my my grandfather take me to our family doctor, and I remember it was like maybe the week before Halloween. It was the week of Halloween. And my grandfather had taken me to our family doctor, and I remember sitting in the lobby of the waiting area of the clinic that we had gone to. And I remember specifically because I remember I used to watch Oprah, and Oprah was on, and we were watching TV, and, you know, they started taking blood work and trying to figure out what was going on. And it was on a Friday. And I remember looking up at the TV, and I told my grandfather, I said, "Dad, I'm starting to see the TV real blurry. I'm not able to see the TV real clear." He's like, "What?" So, you know, we told the doctor, and they sent me home. They were going to check what was going on with all the blood and stuff. Well, that Saturday, it got worse, where I wasn't able to get up. I wasn't able to go to the restroom by myself. I was just laid up in the bed. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. You know, and of course, my grandparents were old. You know, they helped me to go to the restroom. They helped me take a bath. You know, they put me in the bath. They couldn't put me in the shower. You know, so, and my grandmother was like, "If you don't get any better by Sunday morning, we're going to call the ambulance over taking me to the hospital." And I remember that they helped me take a bath. They helped me go to the restroom, and I couldn't get up after that. And then all I remember is Sunday morning, my grandmother and my mom caught the ambulance, and they came to get me. And all I remember is them asking me if it was okay for them to take me to the hospital, and I was gone. I went into a coma for 2 weeks. My heart has stopped twice. They had already signed a paper to release, you know, that if my heart were to stop the third time, they weren't going to revive me. And they thought I was going to be paralyzed from the neck down. 2 weeks later, I get out of coma. You know, of course, they were already planning my funeral arrangements and stuff like that. And of course, all the club from me being in competitions and being in shows and stuff, you know, literally, they said that the waiting room was like full, like with all my, you know, with support and friends and people from high school and people to say their goodbyes and stuff. And so I wake up and I'm blind, you know, and I'm not able to see. And what happened was I had a brain and spinal meningitis, and it caused permanent damage and swelling to my optic nerves. So it's not the pupil that's damaged, it's the nerve that was damaged. So therefore, that's why they couldn't do nothing surgically to fix it, because it was the nerves that were damaged because of the liquid from the brain meningitis that was in my head that caused all that damage. And they were predicting that I was going to be paralyzed from the neck down, that I wasn't going to be able to walk because when, you know, of course, my heart had stopped twice. I guess I had kind of like a stroke when I was in a coma, that like my whole left side still kind of is a little numb and I don't have too much feeling. But they were expecting me not to walk, and I was supposed to be in a wheelchair, you know, for the rest of my life, you know. But the fighter that I am, you know, I just didn't give up, you know. They put me in an assisted home where I was doing therapy and stuff, and I was in the hospital for another month maybe, and they were taking me to therapy, and I started working on it and working on it, and here I am standing before you, you know, and sitting before you being a showgirl. I just stepped down from All American Goddess at Large, which is a national well-known pageant that I beat, you know, 1920 girls. And I just, you know, ended up doing the therapy, and I'm walking now. And the only thing, of course, is that I can't see, but you know, that's still not stopping me from my goals and my dreams.
How much was your drag family a part of your recovery?
Oh, they were there every day. You know, my birth mother was there every day. She actually would show, you know, she got close to people and she got to meet a lot of people. My grandmother wouldn't really go too much because of course she already had the cancer and they didn't want her to be in the hospital too much because I had come down with pneumonia and all that. So they were afraid for her to get sick. So they would show up, and of course, and my grandfather would visit me and stuff. But My birth family was, my drag family was there like every day, every night. You know, they were there, especially those 2 weeks. They were the ones that called everybody to make sure everybody came to say hi. You know, there was one of my best friends at the time. Her name was Teresa. I kept asking for her when I was in a coma. For some reason, they kept saying that I kept asking for Teresa and asking for Teresa. You know, so she showed up, and they were always there by my side. They had a big fundraiser for me. They raised over $3,000 to help me with medical bills. So they were a big part of that. And especially after my recovery, when I got out of a coma, you know, they were the ones that would visit me and pick me up and take me to go eat and take me out of the house and take me out of, you know, stuff, and were the ones that would help me when I wanted to go back on stage, do my makeup and stuff. So they were there through thick and thin. And that's why I will never, ever, ever change my last name or ever, you know, regret that I'm a Whitney because of those reasons, because they were there when I needed them the most.
Was there ever talk about not being able to do drag again, or were you always like, I'm going to get back on stage?
Well, they were, you know, suspecting that I was never going to be able to do it again. And a lot of people, when I was in the wheelchair, you know, a couple of months afterwards, were like a little upset because I wanted to get back on stage. But that's what made me stronger, because I wanted to get back on stage. In my mind, of course, there was never a dull moment in my life where I said, oh, I'm not going to be able to do it. Because even right now, when I still say this to the day, I'll say this to the day I die. I don't care if I would be in a wheelchair. I don't care if I would be in a walker. I don't care what I would do. I'm going to be on that stage because that's my heart. That's my passion. You know, I can be 90 years old and I will still probably be performing.
What was the first time that you were able to get back up on stage?
I got out of the hospital December the 15th. I went back home. And then on December the 27th, I was back on stage with on a wheelchair. And I still remember the song I did. I did No More I Love Yous by Annie Lennox from the Medusa soundtrack. And I had two patches over my eyes, and I was in the wheelchair, and I performed in the wheelchair.
I used to be a lunatic from the gracious days. I used to be all begone and so restless nights. My aching heart would bleed for you to see. Oh, but now
I do find myself bouncing up with sleep, but no chance to make me cry.
No more I love you.
And then a couple of weeks after that, I was in a big pageant that they had, which was the Saints Newcomer of the Year, San Antonio Newcomer of the Year, where I had competed for, and the host, Paulette Lay, was one of my big supporters. I sat there in a ball gown, and they put a chair in the middle of the steps, and I sat there and I performed Bette Midler, To Deserve You. And so it was automatically, like, right after I got out of the hospital that I went back on stage.
Yeah, that is very soon, because
yeah.
You mentioned it was October that you started feeling unwell.
Right.
You were in the coma in November, and then December, you're right back up on stage.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and like I said, I was wheelchair bound, and I was still performing. I you know, because honestly, I think that's what made me fight more and made me, like, overcome it, because I was wanting to get back on stage. You know, so I had the passion for it, and that's what made me realize, no, I need to fight this. You know, I need to keep my head up, and I need to keep going, because if not, I think I wouldn't be alive right now.
Well, you know, on one hand, I'm sure, like, a lot of things just changed dramatically in your life after that point. But on the other hand, there's something very familiar about that person who, you know, how fiercely you were going to the club, like how important it was for you to find your family and be there before you lost your vision. And then after that experience, you know, once again, you're just fiercely expressing who you are,
yeah.
Like nothing can stand in your way.
Right, yeah, and that's just – and that's the reason why I think – you know, everything has its purpose. And I think that's why God gave me a second chance, both because, you know, there's a lot of people out there that think, oh, you know, I'm overweight, or I'm too short, or I'm too tall, or I'm too skinny, and don't want to do certain things because of those reasons. You know, I'm living proof that no matter what kind of obstacle comes in your way, if you are really determined and you want to fulfill your obligations and fulfill your dreams and goals, you have to accomplish them, but you're the only one. They're your dreams, nobody else's. So you have to keep your head up and fight for it.
So do you think of that, like, that December performance is sort of like your I don't know, your comeback appearance? And then, like, returning to the bar and returning to the community, what was different about your performing after that? Like, as you're learning to be a drag queen now with you're having a mobility impairment and you had your vision impaired, how did your act change?
Like I said, I think what changed was I started taking it more serious, you know, where I was like, okay, no, now I want to compete and I want to win because I want to show people that it could be done, you know. But other than that, it didn't really change me. It made me, I'm still the person I am, you know. I don't want people to feel sorry for me. I didn't want that at all, you know. But of course, it came with the territory. It came with it because a lot of people were like, are you okay? Do you need this or do you need that? Or, you know, and I'm very self-efficient. I hate to depend on people for anything. I'm the type of person, if I can do it on my own, I'm going to do it on my own. You know, I can sit there and style my own hair. I can put on my own wigs. I can, you know, I know the way I want it and I can picture what I want it and I'll try it and I'll do it on my own. And of course, I'll let them fix it afterwards and make sure, okay, well, it looks a little smoother and stuff. But, you know, I can sit there and do my own base powder, you know, my makeup, my, you know, if they sit there with me, I can probably do my own contour and kind of do my own blush and stuff and, you know, except, you know, eyebrows and liquid liner because that's hard. But it just made me, you know, the stronger person, and it made me realize, you know, I need to show people that it could be done.
So tell me about the performances that you do now. Are you, like, doing pageants, or are you doing just, like, musical numbers? What do people see when they come to see you on stage?
Well, now, like I said, just last weekend, I was in Daytona Beach, Florida. I just stepped down from All American Goddess at Large. I won that last year in Daytona Beach. Out of 19 girls, I ended up winning, and it's a national pageant. It's well known, you know, so, and what I do is just, it's basically kind of like, a lot of people always ask, like, well, what do you do in the show? It's hard to explain it. You have to see it to know. It's kind of like when you watch an artist do their music video, you know, they act it out. They're not really singing it, but they're lip singing the song. And then they have, like, dancers, or they have, you know, they're in certain outfits, or they have certain things that they do with the song. And that's basically what we do on stage, you know, like, and, you know, I don't do any kind of illusions because I know that damn well, I don't look like nobody. So I don't try to look like nobody. I just try to be me doing, you know, Selena, or I do Shania Twain or Mariah Carey, but I don't try to be an illusion. I just do what I can do, you know, and I perform it the way I can.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, do you have, like, signature numbers or favorite songs?
Oh, most definitely. Selena and Celine Dion are two of my favorite artists of all time. So, you know, of course, I do the ballads, and of course, I can dance, you know, because being a cheerleader, I've always been able to dance. So I just, you know, those are my two favorite artists that you will know that I will go down in history with Celine Dion and Selena.
You know, that's such a great pairing because they're so intense and their names are very similar, but I can't think of any performer I've ever seen who, like, combines them or just, like, references both of them in an act. So that must be really amazing to see.
Yeah. When, you know, and Celine Dion, I guess because of her music and her words and, you know, the songs, the meaning of them. And then Selena, because, of course, she's from Texas, you know, she's from Corpus, and I got to actually meet her in high school. You know, we had a past concert and I got to actually meet her, and, you know, her being a Tejano, you know, from Texas and Tex-Mex and, you know, Tejano. And that will always sit with me very well because, you know, that's somebody I looked up to because she was another one that they doubted would never make it. And, you know, she was already in stardom and she was 23 years old when she lost her life. And, you know, she was on her way to cross over in the album and they told her she couldn't do it and she fought it. And she almost did it until that tragic accident, you know, or the tragedy happened and she got killed.
Yeah, you know, there's so many people who, like, are not familiar with her, and it just it breaks my heart because, like, you know, if that hadn't happened, like, what a star, like, what an icon she would be today.
Oh, most definitely. I'm sorry, you know, I don't think J-Lo would have gotten her stardom that quick if Selena was still alive, because Selena, the movie, was actually what really broke Jennifer Lopez out, you know, because, I mean, she had done other movies and she was a fly girl and she was a dancer, but Selena was who made Jennifer Lopez, you know, because she played her so awesome and was, like, identical to her. Like, when they took the picture for the movie cover she looked just like Selena. And I think that's what really kicked her career off, you know? And I just think if she would have still been alive, she would have been somewhere. She would have been an actress because they were already, she was already making appearances in like the soap operas in Spanish. They call them novelas. So she was already in that. And, you know, she was already doing her English album. I think she would have been a major superstar, you know?
Well, she's living on through you. You're a star with, you know, you're sort of like her partner and bringing her to new audiences.
Oh, well, yeah, no. And I mean, a lot of the girls do Selena, you know, I'm not the only one. Some even do her to the illusion. You know, there's this one girl, her name is Selena. That's her drag name and her performing name. And she looks like her, you know, they say when she, and she, of course she studied her and stuff and does the outfits and stuff. So there's more people that obviously, you know, she lives through, not only just I, but you know, there's a lot of, you know, even the straight community will always have her legacy that lives on.
So how big is the Whitney family today?
Well, it's actually a large family. It's, you know, a lot of us have captured a lot of national titles. Like I'm a former All-American Goddess at Large now. My son, Dakota Whitney, is a former Mr. Gay USA at Large. Cielo Whitney was All-American Gen, and he stepped down with me. You know, so it's taken off. You know, it's kind of, I don't want to give myself the credit, but it's my branch of the family that kind of stepped it up and started doing what they have to do, you know. And I have a son, Mikey, that does Continental, and he's been to Continental. He's been to Nationals. He's, you know, been All-Star Continental. And Alyssa has been Missouri USA at Large, and she's on her way to Miss Texas USA at Large. So it's just, we have it in our blood. The competition is in our blood. We're known. We're known for that.
Tell me about the, you know, when it was the right time for you to transition, and or was there a time, or were you always open with the family about being a woman?
My older brother, no, I kind of hid that from him more than anybody. But my grandparents, out of respect, I waited till they passed, you know, because my grandmother passed away in 2001. My grandfather passed away shortly after in 2003. And that's when I knew, you know, there's nobody else I have to answer to. With all due respect, you know, but there was nobody else. I could be me, you know. I respected them until while they were alive, and it was just time for me to live my life, you know, regardless of what my older brother thought, or, you know, because he's a pastor, he's a Christian pastor. So, of course, to him, it's a sin, and, you know, but I just started doing it on my own, and it just was something that I always wanted to do. And since my grandparents had passed away, you know, I started looking into the laser hair removal. And once I started realizing there's a lot of things that we can do that, okay, it could be done, I started. So at the age of 30 was when I started transforming. I'm going to be, May 7th will be my birthday, and I will be 42 years old.
How much of a role did the queer community play in your transition? Like, do you have people supporting you in the Whitney family?
Oh, of course. Yes, most definitely. I mean, not only my Whitney family, but a lot of people were like, you know what, you be who you want to be, you know, be happy. That's what we live our motto. You know, that's our motto. You know, it's just, you need to be who you want to be and who you feel comfortable being. And of course, the Whitney family has always been supportive of it. My kids have always been supportive of it. You know, they help me out, you know, when I do pageants, they do my makeup, they help me with everything. And, you know, transforming into the transsexual that I am today, of course, they're by my side and they help me. And, you know, it's no doubt in my mind that the gay community has always been so supportive of that. And
what's been the impact? Like, how does it feel to be able to live more authentically and honestly with everyone around you?
Well, it makes me a happy person. You know, it makes me feel complete. You know, it makes me feel like I knew that I was a woman in the inside, and now I'm physically a woman in the outside, you know, so it's kind of like I feel complete. You know, of course, I don't have the final operation, but I don't care. It's not about sex to me. It's about me being comfortable and being in my own skin and knowing that I look, you know, and I've never been able to see what I look like because, of course, I dressed up, you know, and I lived in drag. But being a transsexual, doing hormones and stuff, it's a totally different look. So I don't know what I look like, but I know that I'm not ugly, you know, and I know that now I'm comfortable within my own skin.
In making that change in your life, how have the people around you helped you to, I guess, not make up for, but have they been assisting you, like, visually, like, describing things to you or helping you with, like, your appearance in ways that you wouldn't be able to do because of not being able to see?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Like, all my kids help me with my makeup. They help me with my hair. you know, I have one that dyes my hair, you know, of course, that does my haircuts. You know, there's another one that does my wigs. A lot of them do my makeup. You know, and then there was one of my really good friends that I look up to, and her name was Layla. She's like, you know, since you're going to live your life as a woman and you're blind, I think she recommended me to do cosmetic tattooing. You know, and I never thought about it because I was like, okay, so if I'm going to be blind, you know, I'm not going to have somebody with me every day, all day, you know, so when I wake up in the morning, what am I going to do? You know, like, I can't just draw my eyebrows on or anything like that. So she turned to me and she goes, have you ever thought of doing cosmetic tattooing? And I'm like, you know what? I never thought of that. So I went on and got my eyebrows tattooed, my eyeliners tattooed, my lip liner tattooed. So, you know, I wake up in the morning and I just take a shower and it looks like I have makeup on, you know, and it was a blessing because she suggested that. So, you know, of course, I've been really, really blessed to be surrounded by people who love me and take care of me and look out for me and sometimes even look out for me more than they look out for themselves, you know, and I've been really, really blessed with that and I thank God for that.
Can you describe, like, when you think of yourself, like, is there something that you envision or do you think about your appearance?
Yeah, of course. You know, I always think, like, what do I look like? And I'll ask, like, my kids, you know, like, do I, you know, because sometimes it's like, it amazes me because I guess mentally I have not been able to see what I look like now. So I'm like, does that guy think I'm a real woman? You know, and I'm like, you know, sometimes I feel I'm in an awkward position to where, like, I don't think they know that I was born a male. And it's kind of like weird to me because I'm not used to it, you know, and I'm still kind of in a stage where I'm like, now they have to know that I'm a man, you know, and sometimes they don't. They really don't. And my kids are like, Mom, you don't realize, you know, you look like an older Mexican woman, you know, because I'm 42, you know, and they're like, you look the part. You look like a woman. So don't, why do you doubt yourself? And it's still kind of in the part where I'm like, does he really think I'm a woman? Like, does he not know? You know, because I'm tall. I'm 5'11", you know, and I weigh like 240, you know, I'm thick, you know, I have breasts and everything, but I mean, one, you know, I'm tall, so that should be something that I always think, like, okay, well, I'm tall, so they're going to look at me to begin with because I'm tall. Then I have big breasts, and then, you know, so, and then automatically I think, oh, they're going to start looking at my, you know, the things, the features that they can clock and be like, okay, that is a man, or no, that's a woman, or, you know, but needless to say, I feel like in my mind, I'm like, whether they think I'm a man or a woman, the worst thing that they can say, and you know, and I'm not a cocky person at all. I just have, I'm confident. And I know that the least that they can say is that if they do realize that I'm a man, they can say, well, that's a very beautiful man. You know, and that's how I look at it.
So if folks want to come see you perform or just want to hang out where you hang out, like where can they find you online or are there bars where you have appearances coming up?
Almost definitely. I have a Facebook. It's under Alexis Nicole Whitney. Alexis, AKA Alexis Valerio. That's my, you know, everyday name. And I perform at Tony's Corner Pocket every Tuesday, which is here in Houston, Texas. And of course at Hamburger Mary's, here in Houston on Saturdays. And, you know, there's other local bars that I perform at, like Rich's once a month or JR's once a month and, Rumors in Galveston. But, you know, those are my two home bars is Tony's Corner Pocket and Hamburger Mary's.
Fantastic. Well, Alexis, thank you again so much for joining me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Alexis for joining me. For this week's recommendation, seek out the short film Adults Only, which, full disclosure, was directed by a friend of mine, Heath Daniels, a couple of years ago. It's the wordless story of a deaf man mourning the end of a relationship and struggling to figure out what's next. He's still mired in past memories, disconnected and longing for a connection, and that connection comes in an unpredictable place and an even more unpredictable form. The neon-lit labyrinth of a bathhouse, where he's surrounded by peep shows and public sex.
The short foregoes dialogue, instead using evocative imagery and sexually charged daydreams to illuminate the main character's pain, and also his drive to move on despite not knowing the way. It's hard enough to put yourself in another person's place, particularly someone who doesn't experience the world with the same senses that you do. But the deaf protagonist of Adults Only finds common ground that's hard not to relate to. Heartbreak, loss, and mourning, followed by the thrill of unexpected pleasure. Thanks again for listening, and just a reminder, tickets are now on sale for our upcoming live comedy show in Seattle. Four intrepid drag queens set out on an all-new adventure, role-playing a real game of Dungeons & Dragons for a live audience. Head over to queensofadventure.com to get tickets and get on the mailing list to find out when we're bringing the show to a city near you. Follow Sewers of Paris on Twitter and Facebook to see clips of stuff we talked about, or get in touch at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit sewersofparis.com for links to the books and movies and music and shows that guests brought up. And if you're enjoying the Sewers of Paris, don't forget to click support the show on Patreon to help keep episodes coming for as little as $1 a month. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.